Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. And today we're going to talk about Eat the Document, a novel by Dana Spiotta. So, Chris, this was your pick, so I'm going to let you take it away.
Okay, I'll summarize Eat the Document the best I can. Eat the Document spans the 70s up to 2000, but it might be useful to kind of think of the story as anchored in the late 90s, from which point the story of what comes before seems to be unfolding. Mary and Bobby are sort of the principal characters. And in the late 70s, they accidentally kill a bystander as a result of intended destruction of property activism. They both go into hiding, and the bulk of the novel is set in the late 90s, where each of them has ended up, Bobby, now Nash, running a bookstore and facilitating grassroots but largely feckless activist meetings, and Mary, now Louise, a single mother who is about to have her secret found out by her son Jason. And we occupy the viewpoints of some of the characters around them in the late 90s. Miranda, who is a young woman who has recently sort of moved to the area that Bobby, now Nash, lives in. She's drawn to Nash. And Jason, Louise's son, as well as a couple other people that we can talk about. Basically, we get Mary's backstory in the time leading up to Jason's birth, and kind of her on the run from the FBI, because both her and Bobby are on the FBI's most wanted list after the bomb accidentally kills somebody that they plant. And she's found out by her son Jason. It is a cathartic moment for her, at least as I read it. And she has been waiting for this moment to turn herself in. She finally goes to meet Bobby, now Nash, and they have kind of a heart-to-heart, I guess, and before she turns herself in. And the story ends with Bobby, now Nash, a knock at his door, and he goes to the door, and there's police there. So that is the end. It also ends, I think, sort of fittingly, given the anniversary yesterday in 2000, right before, you know, we're talking about sort of domestic activism and that, you know, there's like destruction of property activism in the 70s. And then this book ends right before the most significant terrorist act of the last, I don't know, maybe of our modern time. So, does that cover it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed. I'm very happy to have read it. It kind of came to me as something that was recommended in, I think, like, honestly, Amazon Analytics sort of pegged this as a book that sort of suited my tastes, because it kept on popping up no matter where I was turning. And and I think, like, I'm going to begin with like a craft question, because it is something that, like, that I wondered about while reading it. And it reminds me a little bit of like some of the things that I really admired about an HBO show that just kind of came out, The White Lotus. And I really admired The White Lotus for a lot of reasons, because it's funny and really great. But it's just sort of the craft of it. It occurred to me in the middle of watching that show that all of these characters seem to be aware of their own flaws, like in very, very conscious ways. They know, like, you know, the dad knows that he's weak, and this old rich lady knows that she's a bore and crazy. And they all know these things about themselves, but they can't change those things about themselves. And that seemed to be a very, like, kind of like a really impressive thing for a writer to do. And Eat the Document, which I think I think really explicitly seems to be dealing with themes of identity, because we follow Mary, you know, over time as she changes her name first to Caroline, her identity, and then to Louise becoming a mom. The book seems to be following and really interested in people's like identities, and yet and these characters just feel hyper aware of like themselves, who they are, what makes them who they are. And it feels a bit like the magician sort of drawing attention to like the like coin, to the coin that they're palming, in a way that like, I wonder how, maybe you guys feel differently about it. It felt like an impressive thing for this book to both be interesting and compelling and to work, when Dana Spiata seems to be so explicit in so many different ways at so many different opportunities with the themes of the book, at least as I read it. And then for the characters to be interesting and compelling, and for their stories to be interesting and compelling, when they seem so aware of themselves. And like, I guess it's like a broad question, but like, how does Dana Spiata pull this book off? Maybe you guys can, if you guys didn't feel similarly about my sense of like the themes of the book and maybe the complications that I would, you know, I see in it with like the characters just sort of being so self-regarding. There's maybe something else that like draws your attention, but how did Dana Spiata pull this book off, you know, given, you know, what it is? That's a broad question. I apologize.
just more of a clarification response from my end, rather than an answer to that question, like, how does she pull it off? So I definitely see what you're saying with Jason, like being hyper aware of his identity. You know, he talks about, you know, the Beach Boys and liking the Beach Boys. And he also, it seems, I think I remember this correctly, that he's talking about his friend Gage, who is like at some point really into the like original analog mono synths of the 70s, like they specifically mentioned the Jupiter 8, which is, you know, like a dream synth for someone like me. But just because it's, you know, one of the classics.
Nerd.
So I definitely... what?
Nerd.
Yeah, definitely. So I definitely see what you're saying, like, in at least Jason being hyper-aware. And I definitely think that kind of leads into his arc where at the end he, like, is a total capitalist piece of shit shill.
Jason? Or Josh?
Maybe I'm getting the characters confused.
The J names?
Yeah, the J names. I didn't necessarily see the hyper awareness so much in the others, and I was wondering what you, maybe an example of, sure, of the hyper awareness you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you, Hans, like, have a good answer, and you're just like, Patrick, you don't need to talk right now.
Well, I have some sense of the kinds of things that Chris is thinking of, I think. But I would be interested in hearing some examples from him first, just because, I mean, it was his question.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think we were kind of introduced to, like, this idea of like, the maybe what we should start with probably is like, before we get to craft is maybe like the finer points of like how something is accomplished, and we can talk about like what was actually accomplished first, because and this kind of like goes to my second question a little bit, and so we can start there. Miranda has this line about context and identity. And I think that really, like, it actually, like, was sort of like, I was already there, and then the line came and was like, oh, wow, okay. Like, this is just, like, at least as far as I'm reading it, like, this feels like it's pretty explicit. But, like, we're introduced to this idea of the flexibility of identity with Mary, who changes her name first to Caroline and then to Louise. And really, like, the very, like, in the first moments that we spend with her, she's thinking ahead, but there's this weird sort of mirroring, really great, like, I think, like, writing, like, to kind of, like, foreground what is to come, like, how she will remember this, and, you know, like, how much, like, where lies will sort of be told long enough that they become, like, true. And her, like, fear of that, her desire to kind of, like, you know, to not, like, erase who she is in the moment, and her struggles with that, but ultimately her ability to just sort of shut that part of herself down and become, for a time, Caroline, and then again become Louise, who then becomes Jason's mother. And that's one. And then Henry, or I'll jump to Henry in a second, but Jason, you already described, is a, you know, a teenager who's hyper aware of, like, himself and the things that make him happy, and how these pieces of things that these are characters who don't do so much as, like, think about the things that, like drive their doing. It's a very navel gazing, like the pieces of this novel are very navel gazery. Like, there's, and I guess, like the name Don DeLillo came up, you know, earlier, while we were talking about this book, there's a kind of a Don DeLillo-esque thing where, like, these characters talk through ideas, but a lot of their ideas, it feels like, center around identity, and, you know, how we know, like who we, you know, how we present ourselves. Bobby Nash has, like, conversations with Miranda about, like, clothes, and Miranda, you know, is like this person who is, like excited not about, like, where she finds herself at the beginning of the novel, but how this new setting might inform her sense of herself and who she might become. Like, these characters are just so hyper aware of themselves that it feels like it should be boring, and it isn't. And Henry, getting to Henry, is this really interesting character, because he's changing in reaction, it seems, to a context that he never really inhabited. Like, he's actually experiencing PTSD and detrimental health effects, as though he went to the Vietnam War, but he never did. And I don't know, like, there's something here about, like, the themes of the novel being about, like, identity, and the characters themselves being obsessed with identity, that should feel one notey and like, but and then I'm impressed with the craft of Spiata for pulling that off, but maybe I'm mistaking something in that one notiness of it, in that real fixed attention on identity. Did you guys read those themes differently than I did? Maybe that's a better thing to start with.
Well, I think that there's a contrast between how different characters are thinking about their identity that maybe has to do with, you know, some of the writing that I've read about this novel sees it as, and maybe this is, like, so obvious that it's not necessarily even worth stating, but some of the writing that I've read about this novel basically frames it as kind of an exploration of the differences between the counterculture of the late 60s and the counterculture of the late 90s or very early 2000s, right? And you've mentioned the fact that it basically cuts off essentially right before 9/11, and, you know, we can dig later into the significance of that choice, right? But, like, I think that the way generationally that different characters think about identity or have the luxury to think about identity is probably part of that idea, right? Because, like, the way that Mary or Louise, or, you know, the way that that character thinks about her identity is very, it's necessary as an adaptation to circumstance, right? It's a survival mechanism, right? She's thinking about identity because she has, she's made this very direct action that has put her in danger, and she needs to literally change her identity as a way of surviving, as a way of hiding. And, you know, a lot of these younger characters in the later, in the chronologically later section of the novel are, they're not living their lives with the same kind of stakes. And so they have the luxury to do things like, you know, move into an anarchist commune and think about, like, how that reflects their identity in that very conscious way, right? And part of that, I think, might just have to do with, like, that's what you do when you're that age, right? I think that that kind of the focus on the construction of the self, whether through kind of this, whether through like political response in the case of Miranda, or whether through immersion in art as an identity in the case of Jason, right? Like those. That's what you do when you're in your late teens, early 20s. I think probably most people that age that aren't enveloped in some kind of externalized crisis, you know, most people that are living in relative material comfort and peace at that age are going to be thinking about their identities in that kind of deliberate, constructed way. And so, I mean, I think part of the reason that she... If we want to think of that as something that Spiot is getting away with, I think part of it is because she's, on the one hand, I think partly it she gets away with it because it's thematically important, right? That, you know, the characters from one generation like have to think about identity in this utilitarian survival context, and the characters in the younger generation have to think of it, or are allowed to think of it in kind of this more, you know, decadent way. And I mean, so I think that thematic weight is part of it. And I think part of it is just choosing characters who are of an age where it's accepted that that's, you know, part of what you do psychologically at that time in your life.
I guess that makes sense. I'm trying to think of a follow-up to that. I feel like there's like, there is, you know, certainly a generational aspect to differentiating how people sort of engage with the forces that shape their own identity and their own involvement, their own agency in that. But it also feels as though it really did feel as though that I guess there's a lot of stuff in this book about considering rather than doing. There's this kind of, I don't know, a couple things with that. Like Mary is frustrated with Bobby's attention to the forces that are sort of like the different, you know, forces that are involved in, you know, whatever safe their organization, you know, considers to be like the poor conditions of the late 70s and like people suffering and dying, you know, overseas in the Vietnam War and elsewhere. And Bobby is a documentary filmmaker, you know, who is, you know, very, very magnetic and interesting, but is ultimately distracted by, you know, in one moment, the pain in the face of the person, the scientist who invented napalm. And that's frustrating to her. And she drives them to action, which ultimately results in the death of an innocent person. And similarly, Bobby later, now Nash, is leading these movements, or not movements, these meetings that ultimately don't really seem to do very much. And I guess, like, this isn't necessarily tied to identity, but there's a thing about this novel that I find very interesting, where it does feel as though it is not necessarily about doing things, which is sort of, it feels like it ticks off a not ticks off as in makes me angry, but ticks off like a sort of like warning bell in my head. Like if this were in workshop, it would be like, you should have people do more things. And I think that would be poor advice for this novel. You know, the things that people do in this novel, I don't know. I guess it feels like there's an obsession with that kind of like, with context and with, you know, like self and the interplay between those two things, rather than your body actually functionally doing things in a physical space, if that makes any sense.
You've mentioned context a few times. I think I found the quote from Miranda about context that you were talking about. So if we are thinking of the same thing, if we're on the same, you know, literal and figurative page here, I suppose, there's a scene very close to the end of the novel where Miranda and Josh are talking about the capitalist commodification of symbols of rebellion, right? And, you know, a vinyl shower curtain with a drawing of Subcomandante Marcos and a note attached explaining that sales helped the Chiapas Zapatista movement, right? Posters for Godard's Les Petits Soldats and the remaster of the Battle of Algiers, and a booklet of Weather Underground Communiques. And the thing that really sets her off is a set of playing cards, right? Playing cards of revolutionary figures for 1995, right? And $19.95. And he says, just to kind of set up her quote, Josh says, this is the purity of capitalism. There's no judgment about content. You have to marvel at its elasticity, its lack of moral need, its honesty. It is the great leveler. All can be and will be commodified. Besides, what's wrong with Emma Goldman being sold at the mall as a cool accessory? It is still Emma Goldman, isn't it? And I mean, I think that quote, that's actually a pretty key, like, there's a lot of thematic weight being carried by that quote, I think, right? And Miranda's response to that is, a confused context is the essence of alienation. So, just, is that the quote you were thinking of, the interaction that you were thinking of?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think that it yes, I guess, like, maybe I should take a step back, because I feel like I've maybe built an edifice in my head that might not make enough sense on its own, if it makes any sense at all. Those are two really good quotes to sort of like unpack. And maybe, like, Patrick, I don't know, you have thoughts about like what those mean in the context of the novel, or, you know, Hans, you too, like, and maybe there's something that's more complicated that we can come to the center of by sort of airing out you guys and what you think.
I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure. Like, I mean, I thought this was certainly a good novel, but I'm realizing as I hear you guys talking about it that, like, I kind of had more trouble with even understanding it than you guys did. I think because of the switches between characters in really what is kind of a limited space. It's a very short novel, And, you know, so we've got Mary, who's a viewpoint character, Bobby, who's a viewpoint character, Jason, who's a viewpoint character and the only person in first person. Then we've got Miranda, who's a viewpoint character, and then is Josh is a viewpoint character at the end?
I don't think so. Right?
No.
Henry is.
Henry
though.
Is. Josh. Is, I don't believe Josh is ever a viewpoint character, which is interesting
okay,
because
okay,
I think he's
Miranda
very,
is, and
he's very significant, even though he's not there much, you know. But anyway.
Josh or Henry?
Yeah.
Josh.
So, like, basically all I'm saying is, you know, I definitely certainly get the undercurrent of, you know, criticism of capitalism and all that, but I definitely kind of had somewhat of a trouble, like, even figuring out how they're all interrelated. But just as a truism, yes, certainly I agree that capitalism appropriates things, and I don't know exactly what a confused context is the essence of alienation means. I mean, I think the essence of alienation is when a boss fucking exploits you, your labor. Like, I think that's the essence of alienation. But so I'm certainly on board with its anti-capitalist sentiments, though I'm not sure of the details. So I'm going to admit my ignorance here and let you guys keep talking and see if I can learn something.
Well, and I think it's, I mean, I agree that this is like a deceptively complex novel, right? It's easy to tell what happens in it at a surface level. I don't think it's difficult to follow, but it's thematically, it's deceptively difficult to really get a handle on. And I think it might be, maybe your experience of it was different, Chris, but I do think that it's, you know, for the most part, I think it's more interested in raising questions or pointing out contradictions than it is in making really clear statements, right? I mean, that, you know, the line that Josh says about capitalism as a means of essentially neutralizing every opposing force by co-opting it within a system of economics. That stood out to me even on a first reading, but I think part of the reason that it stood out to me is not because it's a particularly interesting or clever statement, right? Like, it's not a particularly original perspective. More so because it's one of the few times when the book is relatively straightforward about what it's trying to say, right? And I think that, you know, there are a couple obvious ways that you can read it or that you can think about readings of it that I don't know necessarily stand up to scrutiny, right? I mean, I think I already mentioned that a couple of things that I've read about it have basically pinned it as, like, you can reduce it to, like, in the late 60s and early 70s, countercultural opposition mattered and had real stakes. Now it's all been eaten up by capitalism and turned into nothing, and turned into kind of like a series of images rather than anything with the meaningful opportunity for change, right? And to get to your question of identity, in the late 60s and the early 70s, countercultural identity was a seriously felt, meaningful thing. And now it is a thing that is taken on as an empty postmodern signifier, right? And I think, I mean, that's an easy reading of the novel.
That.
Do you think that's... Do you think that that's an oversimplification of what's actually being portrayed in the novel?
I think not an oversimplification, but in terms of like what's being portrayed. But you mentioned how this is not necessarily trying to provide answers so much as raise questions. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about the novel was what I sensed to be, and I think maybe Henry comes into this too a little bit, because he's sort of an anomalous character. We should talk about him. But the sense that I had, I think the two of those quotes sort of mashed together. Josh's capitalism appropriates, capitalism appropriating, you know, counterculture activism and everything. Capitalism appropriates everything. It is a context in which, it is a hyper context in which individual contexts can be reframed, lose their meaning, but still be exchanged as currency. And then if capitalism is your context, which is, I think, like sort of a Joshy sort of thing, then you are always sure-footed. You know, you're always comfortable. You know, everything is just is just signs and signifiers waiting to be, you know, sort of folded into the language of currency. And Miranda, what I think is kind of really lovely about the book is the pain of that, like the pain, like the human pain of being, of feeling, you know, your context stripped from you. And there's an aspect of identity there. There's a way that I feel like these things fold together that isn't neat, but is still circumscribed in this novel and is still interesting. And I think that's where I come at it from. I'm less interested in the appropriation, the activism is not the thing that interests me the most. It's the human pain element of it, the sense of alienation. And, you know, like Miranda, you know, is Miranda upset because these figures really meant something, or is she upset because their meaning something informed some sense of herself that, like, them being appropriated into a capitalist system, you know, takes that away? I don't know. Like, I feel a bit like maybe my own particular sort of like interests color my reading of this text, but between the two quotes, it's funny that you gravitate toward Josh's. I really gravitated toward hers.
Well, and I do think that they bind to each other, right? They're important next to each other. I didn't mean to, like, I wanted to make sure that we paid attention to Josh's, but I think hers, you know, they're important next to each other. Go ahead. I didn't want you to feel like I was downplaying the importance of her quote.
Yeah. I guess this is maybe, rather than sort of like settle in, like, let's jump to Henry, because like Henry is a really, he feels like such a, like, Josh is complicating it. Josh is not complicating, rather. Josh is really important, and maybe he complicates, but mostly I feel like he's sort of like this he's sort of a reference point for that quote, like to be the person to say that and to sort of provide that aspect on the novel. But then Henry is like super complicated, and I don't know rather than sort of say what, like, I'm doing with Henry in reading this novel, like, Henry is this person who's sort of unnecessary to the sequence of events, and he's very strange because there's a kind of a weird magical realist element to Henry, where he is Nash's friend. He has visions that are akin to like PTSD. He has health problems that are akin to exposure to Agent Orange, or potentially the drugs that he's taking for his mental health. But he never really went to war. He never really had those experiences or was exposed to those things to have those conditions. And he has this insight, a dream, that is very uncanny in how it sort of taps into what Nash did back in the 70s, which, as far as I'm aware, Nash never shared with him or shares with him. Henry is bizarre, and I kind of feel like it may be simple enough to just sort of ask, what the fuck is up with Henry? And how did you guys, like, read him, you know, from craft or from theme or whatever?
Well, I think that Henry, just off the top of my head, I mean, I do also, Henry is interesting in terms of, like, how he fits in, right? I mean, I don't know that he's an easy... I mentioned, like, the kind of basic critique of, you know, 90s and 60s counterculture, and he doesn't necessarily fit in like an obvious, easy way to that. That's springing to mind for me, at least, right? But I think that Henry is, I talked a little bit about, partly about the novel as something that spends a lot of time raising questions, right? And Henry raises the question, I think, of collective guilt, maybe, or one thing that you and I outside the context of this novel, I think one thing that you and I have kind of talked about a lot, right, is like how do you respond psychologically? What is the appropriate level to respond psychologically to the awareness of sadness and suffering in the world, right? And, you know, how much attention is enough to discharge your moral responsibility, right? And or do you have a moral responsibility to respond to sadness and suffering, or is it actually counterproductive to allow yourself to be moved emotionally by the plight of people that you're totally unconnected to, right? And, you know, we use the example...
I feel cheated. Like, I have the answer to this question.
Well, okay. Yeah. And I think that Henry is, like, experiencing that in... He's having a certain set of symptoms, right? And his way of drawing an understanding or a meaning of those symptoms is to say, like, okay, I am taking into myself the consequences of the actions of my country, right? Am I misunderstanding that? He's like, in a weird way, he's like suffering on behalf of soldiers who were exposed to substances they didn't understand, for instance, right? Patrick, I'm sure that you've read a lot of, like, moral philosophy about how to respond to suffering in the world, right? Like, do you have thoughts about that connect to Henry? Or how Henry acts or is portrayed?
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't necessarily seen Henry as, like... Like you said, you know, he's like a symbol of collective guilt. But I'm not sure I saw it that way, simply because, like, in the end, he dies of, is it non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Some sort of lymphoma.
It doesn't matter which one. Lymphoma, yeah. Right, but yeah, and it's indicated that the drug he'd been taking, Nepenthex, has that as an effect. Like, so he ultimately, that to me meant it was leaning away from collective guilt, him as a symbol as of collective guilt, and more him as a symbol of the trauma of capitalist imperialism, or the trauma of you know, capitalist appropriation. Not that that's necessarily mutually exclusive with collective guilt when I think about it.
Well, he's experiencing the trauma.
Well, all I was going to say is, like, if we're talking about more obligations, you know, there, you know, on one spectrum, we've got like a hardline utilitarian like Peter Singer, who suggests that our moral duties to other people, to people who are suffering and impoverished and whatnot, are quite severe, you know, so that, you know, if Henry is a symbol of collective guilt, then, you know, from that perspective, his guilt is absolutely justified. You know, he should feel guilty for not doing more. You know, at least on Singer's reading, which is a very hardline utilitarian, severe reading, like, you know, you should be sacrificing everything to help out the less fortunate up to the point that you would live kind of an austere, not so happy existence yourself. Then we got, you know, other, say not as hardliner consequentialists who probably say, you know, our duties to others are very, very strong, though not to the point that we have to give up life hopes or life purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was going to say about Henry, like, Henry has the experience of, like, things happen in his body that are actually because of the effect of this drug, right? But he interprets them and understands them as being the effect of abuses during the Vietnam War, right? So he has this phenomenon that in an objective way turns out to just be a side effect of a drug, right? But his way of understanding that phenomenon is experiencing the suffering caused by an atrocity of war committed by his generation of Americans. So when I talk about him as a symbol of collective guilt, that's kind of what I mean, that he has this, the way that he reads his experience is as the experience of the trauma of the, again, I guess I'm repeating myself now, right? But like his way of reading that is, it seems to suggest responsibility or suffering on behalf of something he did not personally participate in, right?
Right.
And I don't think, I mean, I absolutely think that, you know.
Right, absolutely.
I think your reading and mine are, they're not at all exclusive, right? They're complementary.
Right, yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you. Like, yeah, I think collective guilt is right. Capitalist trauma is right. I think it's both. Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
Sorry, we're talking about trauma and... there's something about the more confused I am about this book, the more I like it. I think there's really like it doesn't feel as though it's kind of like you know, trying to mean nothing. Even though it feels like there's a lot of different ways through this book, I'm at least that's my impression. You know, it it is actually a nice sort of jumping off point for a lot of different like avenues of inquiry into like we could talk about like Nash and like his the attention he pays to like this the text of everything around him, and I think like we could talk about like the you know experience of you know Mary Caroline Louise as she sort of like lives for a time with you know feminists in a commune and is raped and becomes a mother and finds meaning in motherhood. I'm curious because we're talking about the trauma of this time of like the 70s through 2000 and what it means or it might mean like dramatically, thematically to have the book end in 2000, which this book was written in, I should have looked, 08, right? It came out in like 08?
I think it came out in 2006.
2006. I knew it was an even number.
Yeah.
I had like...
Let me double check that.
It was either 2006 or 2008.
Let me verify that. Yeah, 2006.
Verify that. So obviously, like, there might be some sort of like mechanics, like narrative mechanics reason for it to end in 2000. But I can't think of one. Like, I don't think like, you know, maybe the internet is just too powerful and I don't know. But why 2000? And is there a connection between the trauma that you're talking about, Hans and Patrick, attached to like the sort of defining sort of conflict of that generation, the Vietnam War, and then 9/11?
Off the top of my head, I'd say that some of the things that Spiotta portrays, some of the ways that Spiotta is portraying countercultural elements in 1999 and 2000 kind of stopped being so much of an issue after 9/11, right? In the sense that, like, you know, like Nash runs this set of groups that are basically just kind of like they do hypothetical direct actions, right? Like they sit around, every group kind of sits around and dreams up more and more Baroque sorts of, more and more Baroque kinds of essentially fake direct actions against capitalism, right? And, you know, after 9/11, you start to have, at least for some period of time after 9/11, from maybe like 2000, let's say like 2003 to maybe like 2000, I don't know, basically from like the beginning of the Iraq War until maybe like the, I don't know, like the second time Bush got elected, all of a sudden, like there was this significant unifying cause and idea for the counterculture, right? Either stop the war or get rid of the people that started the war, or, you know. So I think a lot of that aimlessness, the aimlessness and the ways in which symbols were neutralized by capitalism for a certain period of time following 9/11, I think those weren't really issues so much for a while because everybody had a kind of central cause, or everybody who wanted to be countercultural had a kind of central cause, or just, you know, everybody who was inclined to opposing abuses of military power and capitalism had a pretty central defining cause. And at some point that unity kind of, you know, obviously that unity and direction kind of dissipated. And it's, you know, kind of come and gone and clustered around other things. But as of 2006, I think it was just very difficult to tell. Like there's a way that, you know, if you'd written this and it was set in 2002 or 2003, I think it would be it would just be very, very different because of the way that 9/11 and the Iraq War kind of dominated people's experiences of politics, right? And I don't know if I don't know if like the focus, I don't know if in 2006 Spiotta would have said, okay, now that we have the Iraq War and the Bush administration to oppose, like now that aimlessness and co-opt and prone to that, that proneness to co-option, those are no longer issues, right? I don't think she would have said that, but I think that like I don't think that you could have written it then really being able to say how all that was going to shake out. There's a way that 9/11 put a cap on a particular type of era that's being described in this novel, so it had to happen before 9/11.
The peak of, like, it also, I mean, like, Josh is working for a website. The peak of, like, what is it, like, malaise or, like, just sort of relaxing into, like, what capitalism in the 80s and 90s was sort of doing, and like the receding memory of the Vietnam War and all of it, just basically landing large groups of people into in places that in a place where they didn't really know what to do about what. Is that kind of another way of saying it? Okay.
Yeah.
If I remember, a lack of
moral urgency, you know?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, Patrick, what were you saying?
Yeah, well, all I was going to say is that, you know, I grew up in the 80s. And, you know, I'm old enough to feel like I'm actually from the 80s, as opposed to my wife, who was born in 1987. She doesn't remember anything about it, whereas I was born in 82. So I kind of feel like I'm as much a child of the 80s as the 90s. And like my niece Piper, who is 16, she is super woke. Like, she is aware of the various problems going on in the world right now, and, you know, is upset about them. Whereas when I was 16 in 1998, like I had no conception of these things, and I think that's reflective of what we're talking about here, which is that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the just like capitalism didn't seem like as big of a problem. You know, it still was. Certainly things were going on, but it certainly wasn't in the collective psyche of the United States at that time, where you know, we got this monumental problem that, you know, needs to be addressed. And so I guess I'm just agreeing with your kind of characterization of why the novel ends where it does, Hans.
Well, I think, unless you guys have more to add, you know, like what you said, Hans, like, it's deceptively complicated because the sequence of events is not complicated. The story's told mostly very straight. The characters are very, like, open and explicit about their opinions and their ideas. Even though obfuscation is, like, central to the novel, we're never really lied to about really anything that I can think of, or nothing's really kept from the reader, and yet it's complicated. I still really like it. I really, really liked this book.
Yeah. I don't know. This isn't really a question. It's just a little detail that I thought was interesting that I think is indicative of some of the subtlety of what's happening here, right? So Bobby / Nash, one character, I mean, I think we didn't talk a lot about him and what he represents, and it sounds like we won't have time to, but there's a way that he is always, as the novel goes on, you realize more and more how ambivalent he is and how he kind of is comfortable with a level of subtlety or uncertainty that a lot of the other characters are. And one way that that's revealed early on is he's drinking Coke, and Miranda says, oh, well, you shouldn't drink Coke. And they have a little chat about brand names and the way that we relate to brand names and whether, you know, shortening brand names is bad and seeing beauty in brand names is bad. And I realized, this will connect to that, I swear. So there's this interest in brand names that he shows, right? And kind of a comfort he has with the idea of branding that some of the other characters don't have, at least in that interaction. And at the beginning of the novel, when Mary is taking on her first new identity, one of the things she thinks is there can't be any relationship between your old and new names, right? There can't be like a cute little game that links the old and new names. Don't make a little joke out of it. And I realized his old full name was Bobby DeSoto. His new name is Nash. Nash and DeSoto, what do those two words have in common? They're both defunct car brands. They're cars. Nash is a car. The Nash Metropolitan Company was a car company. They made the Nash. It's a car brand. And DeSoto was a subdivision of the Chrysler Corporation. They both, Nash and DeSoto both went out of business in the late 50s, early 60s. So he is, in fact, doing a little game like that with his own names that is, in fact, connected to branding. So that's the kind of subtlety that I think the way that she plays with little details like that is part of what makes this effective beyond kind of the obvious, the way that you can kind of boil it down to a straightforward critique.
It sounds like a very serious novel if you haven't read it yet and you're listening to this. It sounds like it would be like super cerebral, and it is, but it is fun. It feels like it's having fun and it's fun to read.
So, what are you picking next, Hans?
Well, so this is a little bit of this is somewhat of a departure from the kind of things that I usually pick generally. But I really want to reread and discuss. And Chris, I believe you have read this. I don't know if you have, Patrick. Sphere by Michael Crichton.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm personally, will be trying to reread because it's a very, very quick read, at least if you're, you know, using a printed version, right? Because it's a popcorn book. It's very easy to get through. I'm also, for my own edification, I'm going to reread Solaris and Roadside Picnic.
Mm.
If you guys, and I'm not asking you guys to reread Solaris or Roadside Picnic, but I will be thinking a little bit about how it relates to that tradition of kind of philosophical literary sci-fi. So,
yeah.
Okay.
I've never read Solaris, but I've read Roadside Picnic.
Okay. Yeah, I knew it's that. Cool. I figured Solaris that you guys had cool. probably read one of those two at least. So,
I've read Solaris and I read Roadside Picnic. I don't think I've read Sphere.
I think it's my favorite Crichton novel. I think you and I talked about this, Hans. Sphere is very enjoyable novel. Terrible movie.
Terrible movie. Yeah, it might be. I think it might be the only thing of his that actually, you know, is good. Frankly.
Yeah. Oh, so you are thinking of it as? Because I'm super intrigued by this pick. Are you thinking of it as a like? Do you think of it as a literary novel?
I don't think it was written as such, I don't think that he wanted to write a literary novel, but I think it's the only thing that he's done that actually has enough depth to be approached and thought about in that way. assuming okay. that I like it as okay. much now as I did when I was 20, which is the last time I read it. So there's a caveat there. I haven't actually read the thing in a long time. But
that's super interesting. It's super interesting to me because I was really thinking of next time saying I want to read Solaris again, and choosing that.
Well, like I said, I will be rereading Solaris. I think I'll just save that. And talking about that. So I'd like to be able to bring that
in.
Yeah. So, yeah. Have you read Sphere, Patrick?
Okay, cool. No,
Patrick,
I've never read Sphere. No.
Okay.
No. Cool. As I said, I've read Solaris and Roadside Picnic. You know, I any sci-fi that I can think of as literary sci-fi, I like reading. So, cool. All right. All right, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our discussion of Eat the Document by Dana Spiata. You will, if you tune in next time, it looks like we're going to talk about Michael Crichton's Sphere and maybe some of the some other sci-fi classics. So see you then.